But let's get started with what I want to deal with tonight. And that is really to describe to you the phases of mourning which take place after a person passes away. Many of us are familiar with them because, unfortunately, many of us have suffered them. We've had to deal with either close personal relatives who did pass away or support people who have had close personal relatives who passed away. And yet, the first thing which I would refer you to is the very first source in my packet on page one from Rav Soloveitchik. Rav Soloveitchik has an extraordinary book that was printed posthumously called Out of the Whirlwind. It deals not only with the questions of mourning, but also deals with the ultimate questions of tzaddik v'ra lo, rasha v'tov lo, of fairness in this world. And yet Rav Soloveitchik, in part of his first article there in Out of the Whirlwind, places a very simple piece. And that is that when it comes to emotions, or in his words, emotions like the tide, reach a high mark, make an about face, and begin to recede. Therefore, the Torah recommended to man not only to submit himself to the emotional onslaught, but to gradually and slowly redeem himself from its impact. In other words, the laws of Avilut, most of which are either governed by as mitzvot Rabbanan or by minhag or as custom, really are meant to help a person come to terms with the loss that they're now facing. The first initial period of time, the gut-wrenching loss when a person passes away, and then slowly the shiva, which is actually divided into two parts, the first 3 days, which are the most intense, and the subsequent 4 days. Then the following days of shloshim, which is the end of mourning, except for a parent. And then finally, for a parent, the 12 months of mourning. And of course, Rav Soloveitchik also dealt with elsewhere why it is that for a child who may have passed away, we only mourn 30 days, whereas for a parent who may have lived a full and productive life, we mourn the entire year. And while Chazal talked to us about the idea of kavod av v'em, of kibud av v'em, of honoring parents, and that's why we have the year, Rav Soloveitchik also talked about the fact that there is an ultimate loss when parents pass, and that is the loss of Mesorah, of the tradition, that you lose that connection to the past, and that's why the mourning lasts longer. And so, as Rav Soloveitchik concludes in that paragraph, therefore the halakha divided mourning into various stages. The very first stage is called aninut. Aninut is the time from when a person passes away and until the burial. And during that period of aninut, people find themselves in a very unusual state, as we'll see in a moment, that they're exempted from positive commands. Now, the source of aninut is twofold. One is on a biblical level, midiyoraita, and that's source one, the first paragraph, where we first find a reference to it, that in the, following the deaths of Aaron's two sons, there comes a time where Aaron is questioned by Moshe about the korbanot that he brought, and he writes, "Va'achalti chatat hayom hayitav ben Hashem," that if he had eaten from the special korban of Rosh Chodesh, would it have found favor in God's eyes? We explain that Aaron HaKohen at that point was prohibited from participating in the regular kinds of korbanot, and that's the first source where we find of aninut, prior to the burial. The second source you find in the Torah is actually talking about the question of maaser, or the vidui maaser, where we make a proclamation at the end of every three-year cycle. And we write, lo achalti ba'oni mimenu, that I didn't eat from this maaser when I was in a stage of aninut. Now, aninut is that first stage, and so we see that biblically there are concepts of aninut, and yet the Gemara in the Bavli, in the Masechet Brachot, goes even further, quoting a Mishnah. And the Mishnah writes, mi shemeto mutal lufanav, if a person has a body of someone who has passed away still in front of them, in other words, prior to burial, patur mikriyat shema, umina tefillah, umina tefillin. is exempted from saying Shema, from davening Shmoneh Esrei, and even from wearing tefillin. Umikol mitzvot amurot b'Torah. And in including this is also every one of the mitzvot, the positive commands that are found in the Torah. And that's the guiding principle, that they're prohibited from doing these kinds of things. Rav Soloveitchik noted, by the way, that if you look, there's two different terminologies. Within the terminology of the Chumash, you found the word ba'oni, aminut. But when it's talking about the rabbinic prohibitions, there the prohibitions are referred to classically as mi shemeto mutal lufanav. In the Shiurei HaRav, which are a compendium of shiurim, of classes that Rav Soloveitchik offered, he explains part of the reason behind it. And he quotes Rashi, and he says that Rashi, first of all, a person who is an onen is exempted from the positive mitzvot because of the principle of osek b'mitzvah patur min ha-mitzvah. That if a person is involved in one mitzvah, they're exempted from another mitzvah. And so as a result, we even find stories, nothing to do with Avelut, but stories in the Talmud of great Tanaim and Amoraim who were so involved in their learning that they were even exempted from davening because they were doing one mitzvah, and therefore that mitzvah is not superseded at that moment by another mitzvah. There are, of course, many rules to this, but here the person is involved totally with the idea of taking care of funeral arrangements, and therefore they're exempted from those mitzvot. But in addition to it, there are those three mitzvot that are mentioned, saying the Shema and saying the Shemoneh Esrei and wearing tefillin. And the question is, why would those have been specifically identified within the source of the Mishnah? And there Rav Soloveitchik explains the reason is not only because Osek b'mitzvah, patur min mitzvah, that if a person's involved in a mitzvah, they're exempted from stopping it to do another mitzvah, but also because those three mitzvot specifically require a level of intent that a person who is involved in mourning and involved in arranging for a funeral can't have that level of intent that would be necessary. So you see at the time of Aminut that there are two really guiding principles. One is the principle that you have to take care of what needs to be taken care of, and therefore Chazal exempted you from other mitzvot. And two is that there's a state of mind at that point where we need to recognize the person can't concentrate and can't be involved in anything beyond the immediate arrangements. In fact, I often talk to people at their time of Animut when arrangements are being made at funerals, and we talk about the fact that for that initial period of time, many people find themselves in a state of what we'll call autopilot, where they're really just totally focused, able to take care of what needs to be taken care of, not fully dealing with everything that has to be dealt with emotionally because they have that focus on that moment. Interestingly, on page 2 in source 2, the Tosfot ask a question. And they say, are the positive commandments, are we exempted from them or are we forbidden from performing them? And quoting from Rashi, who says, "V'ein zakuk levarech," you don't have to bench, you don't have to make a bracha, Tosfot reinterprets that as, Nire lomar eino mivarech, that it's as if it says eino rishai livarech, because you cannot make a bracha. And during the period of animut, therefore, if a person wanted to daven, they're not allowed to. Two reasons: kvodo shome, because it would violate the honor that we have to exhibit towards the person who has passed away. Inami mitnei she'ein lo mishu samaso, because no one else will take care of the things you need to take care of. Now, this leads to some fascinating halachic questions about what would happen in a situation where a person has absolutely no involvement. And so we'll talk about in a little bit, the next source, what would happen in a situation where a person has no involvement because they're at a distance, they can't get involved in any way in the funeral. They only find out the funeral is going to happen at what time would they start sitting Shiva? Would Aninut ever take place if you have no involvement whatsoever? And so the Poskim today talk about that if a person has potential involvement, if even the involvement will be calling in to deliver a eulogy at a funeral, that that person may remain in aninut until that time, it is entirely possible, even with minimal or potential involvement, for a person still to be an onin, as an onin, a tour from all of the mitzvot. Interestingly, what happens in terms of, let's say, the shachrit that a person did in davening? And so if a funeral takes place in the morning, and it's early enough in the morning that when a person comes back, there's enough time to still daven shachrit, they should daven shachrit. The Mishnah Brura actually deals, and this is the second paragraph in source 2 on page 2, actually deals with another case. And that is, what would happen if when a person passed away, it was mid-morning, but that the relative who survived hadn't had a chance to daven yet? When it comes to mincha, after the funeral, should that person say two shmona esres? The reason being, are we considering it as if a person had forgotten or had been unable to daven in some way? Or was the requirement to daven entirely removed? If a person had a moment where they were required to daven and then became an onen, the next time you daven, you're actually supposed to make it up. If there had never been that moment, then you don't have to make anything up at all. Now, in source 3, which I provided, is a fascinating and very practical question, which we deal with, unfortunately, often. And that's the question of, when does a person shift from being an onen to beginning to be an avel, to be a mourner? When does aninut end and shiva begin? Now, the simplest answer is at the point of burial. But what happens if a person isn't at the burial? And this is a very famous machloket which took place in the late 19th century between two great Rosh Hashivas of the very same yeshiva. On one side was the Netziv, Rav Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin, and on the other side was Rav Rafal Shapiro, his son-in-law. The Netziv had one of the Netziv's daughters was Sarah Rasha. Sarah Rasha married Rav Rafal Shapiro. After the Netziv closed the yeshiva of Volozhin, after a period of time, his son-in-law reopened it. Those are the two great personalities. And the question arose, what happens when you're not going to a funeral? If you go to a funeral, we know aninut concludes once the funeral is over, possibly a little bit in the middle of it, and avelut starts afterwards. So for example, everyone is familiar at a funeral that at the end of the funeral, there is a shura, where we have the two lines comforting the mourners who walk in between. We're comforting mourners. That means they're already an avelut. The aninut has ended. But when does that start if you're not going to be at the funeral? So Rav Rafal Shapiro took the position that based on precedent, if you're not going to the funeral, as soon as you hear about the passing of the immediate relative, that you would start sitting shiva. His example for this is something also we're familiar with, even though in ancient times it was in a different sense. And that is, nowadays, if somebody has a relative who passed away and the relative is being transported to Israel for burial, those members of the family who don't go to Israel, as soon as the casket is handed over for transport, their avelut begins, their shiva begins. And so therefore, it's before the burial, but for them, their shiva begins right away. If people are accompanying the deceased to Israel, their shiva won't start until after the funeral. So we see this already in action in a regular case. Rav Rafal Shapiro said, that's the scenario, and that's the way it should be. If you're not going to the funeral, you just hear about it. You also start shiva immediately. difference between those two cases? The first, you were involved with making arrangements and with the deceased. The meto mutal lefanav, the deceased was there and then was taken away. The second case, the deceased was never there. You only heard about it at a distance. In that case, Rabbi Rafal Shapiro says, you start immediately. This happens many times, unfortunately, especially nowadays with COVID. Someone passes away and the member of the family can't go to the funeral. They start sitting Shiva, according to Rabbi Rafal Shapiro, immediately. Interestingly, however, the Netziv disagreed. And the Netziv, the father-in-law, was of the position that actually this is comparable to a case the Shulchan Aruch mentions in Siman Shin Ayin Hei, that if someone had been crucified, it's horrific to imagine that our Shulchan Aruch has to talk about Jews who were crucified, because it was still taking place at the time of the Shulchan Aruch. If a Jew was crucified and someone started sitting Shiva immediately, that they would have to start again at the time of burial. The Netziv says that's the precedent we should be looking at. And therefore, even if a person's not going to the funeral, they have to wait until the burial to start sitting Shiva. They may not be onanim because they have no involvement, but they have to wait until sitting Shiva. The most fascinating piece of this is in the first two lines of that paragraph, which I brought in source 3, Rabbi Rafal Shapiro writes the following. Vizaya pashut etzli. The halacha I considered was very obvious and simple, that as soon as you hear, you start sitting Shiva. V'horeti chen, v'chein ki Shabbat telegram mivarsham miptirat marchami agaon. And that's what I paskined when the telegram came from Warsaw to Volozhin that my father-in-law passed away. And it said the burial is going to be the next day. Nevertheless, I paskin for my wife, the daughter of the Netziv, that she should immediately sit Shiva that day and start the first day from when they found out and not the next day of the burial. This source often is quoted to say how strongly he felt against his father-in-law's position. Interestingly, later on in the next paragraph actually talks about the fact that later he received a copy of his father-in-law's sefer, the Meshiv Dover, his responsum, and there he read his father-in-law's position. Just from a historical perspective, and this is a little different than we normally would do in this shiur, the Netziv passed away in 1893. The Meshiv Davar, his book of responsa, were also published in 1893, posthumously, after he passed away. And in fact, on the title page, there is a paragraph of apology that they weren't able to check with the Netziv some details because he had already passed away. So actually, the chronology of this is with Rafal Shapiro's position that you start sitting Shiva from the moment you hear, if you're not going to the funeral, was a position he took with his wife. He did not necessarily know that his wife's father disagreed with him until later on, but he still maintained his position throughout. This is also the position of Rav Moshe Feinstein. It was also the position of Rav Henkin, the great poskim of America in the 20th century. And this is the most common position which takes place halachically. That when you find out if you're not going, or when your involvement ends and the casket is transported, Shiva starts immediately. Only those going to the funeral would start counting their Shiva from the time of the funeral. Now, the source of burial is source number 4, the bottom of page 2, where we talk about, unfortunately, a very difficult situation of a capital case in court where someone was executed by the court. And thereafter, they were executed by the court as the ultimate of deterrence. Their body was hung until nightfall. But then it says, and this is the quote of the Mishnah in Sanhedrin, that you're not allowed to have that body be out and unburied overnight, but rather the body must be buried at night. And that's the same halacha teaches the Mishnah and the Gemara, and that's the source we find actually within the Chumash for burial. Now, the definition of burial is burial in the ground. Even though nowadays there is a major machloket which is going about in Israel, for example, in Har Menuchot, where they built multi-storied structures on Har Menuchot, where the burial in the ground is in a structure that has a flatbed that is then has dirt filled in. So they're buried in ground that has been transported to a place that's a multi-story place. Many poskim permit this. This is very, very common in Israel today. It was a fascinating question, but it seems to be that the custom for most have already defined it. Nevertheless, we also know that while we're not allowed to allow a person not to be buried overnight, in other words, not to allow it to go to the next day, there are cases where we do delay a burial. And if you look in source 5, the top of page 3, I quote from the Shulchan Aruch, Ela im ken helimu lichvodo, you're prohibited from postponing a burial unless if it is to honor the deceased. And the definition of to honor the deceased is, for example, the end of that line, O kadeshi avo provim uleshmiya ayarot, that if relatives need to come, if the announcement needs to go out, burial in Jewish tradition has to happen as soon as possible. That soon as possible is supposed to be that same day. In Israel, they'll bury at night. In the United States, we don't bury at night, not because it's halachically prohibited, but it is complicated in terms of the government often. And nevertheless, it can be postponed. But where it can't be postponed, interestingly, is in Yerushalayim. Burial in Yerushalayim is not allowed to be postponed. So the question is, and that's a Gemara, by the way, above a comma. It says, "Yerushalayim amru en malimin ba'atamet," under no conditions you ever postpone a burial. But for some of us, we know that there are cases where, for example, someone passes away in Israel and they'll wait for family to come from overseas. And they do postpone it. So how is that possible? So Rabbi Yechiel Michal Tukachinsky, who was the Rosh Hashiva of the famous Yeshiva Sages Chaim in Israel, he passed away in 1955, wrote the seminal work on death and mourning called Gesher HaChaim. And Gesher HaChaim, in that work, Rav Tukachinsky explains that when the Gemara says that in Yerushalayim you never postpone a burial, that specifically within the old city of Yerushalayim, where they would be able to eat korbanot, kodshim kalim, and also ma'aser sheni. And in fact, in his work, he gives the boundaries based on modern Yerushalayim. And so he says, Har Tzion, Makom Tzion, Ve'ir David, Vulei Yerushalayim and Mekudesha Bedarom, on the south side, Shipulei Har Tzion, the decline from Mount Zion, and he explains exactly where it is, Bamizrach Chomat Harabayit, on the east, the old city walls, Betzafon Chomat Ha'ir, okay, and Achshaviot, Shiyasoda Chomat Nechemia, Achshaviot, the ones that are now, that we consider to have been put in place by Nehemiah originally, the Maharav on the west, Hakavanim Shachmi Beit Doar Hayashan, and on the west side, a straight line from the old post office, Rechavat Allenby, Ad Rechov Mamilo Merkaz Mischari, and down to Mamilo. In that area was considered the old city of Yerushalayim, and burials within that area were never postponed. Har Menuchot obviously is well outside, and that's why in Yerushalayim sometimes it can be postponed. Now, at the funeral, obviously, many things take place. There's a hesped, there are eulogies, there is a mitzvah to recite eulogies. There's a famous question as to whether or not you're allowed to listen to a person's final will not to deliver a eulogy or not. There's questions of when you can say a eulogy and when you can't. In the times of the Mishnah, when eulogies were taking place, they actually had musical accompaniment. They would have chalilim being played. They were creating a mood music to it. And in fact, that's the source for some of you may be familiar in Israel today on memorial days. For example, on the memorial day for Chayalei Tzahal, Yom HaZikaron, that very often there's music. And we are sometimes taken aback, or you'll even find music during the 3 weeks of, by some places. And part of it was based on one of the ancient customs of burials, that there is such a thing as sad music, which brings about sadness that should be permitted. In the United States, in Europe, it wasn't familiar to be done. And at funerals today, you don't find music, but we do have that origin within the Talmud. Another thing that takes place, obviously, is the tearing of kriya. And the tearing of kriya, again, has a source, which comes from the Chumash, that ultimately we talk about the fact that when it came time for Aaron to mourn his son's deaths, and he wasn't allowed to mourn, we talked about the fact that he wasn't allowed to tear his clothing. A person, however, who is an Avelut, who doesn't do so, in that case, they're violating a rabbinic prohibition, and there is punishment from the heavens, we describe it as. The Shulchan Aruch, though, in Source 7, also talks about something which I frequently find people making a mistake for. And it's a very simple, small detail. That you need to tear kriya. The kriya that you need to tear is vertical, not horizontal, because horizontal might look just like a plain rip. And it has to be, in the words of the Shulchan Aruch, Eino yotze b'kriya zo v'tzarich likra b'beit ha-tzavah, that ultimately, if you tear on a seam, that's not considered tearing for a parent. And also, it has to be from the neck. Sometimes I've gone places and I've seen that the kriya was in the middle of a shirt. It's not classic according to what the Shulchan Aruch says, but rather it is a lapel. It's from where the neckline would be itself. When is the kriya supposed to be torn? Source 8. Really, kriya is supposed to be torn b'shat yitziat neshama. It's the Gemara in Shabbos. When a person passes away, you're supposed to tear kriya. Interestingly, not just the immediate relatives, but whoever is present at the time of yitziat neshama is supposed to tear kriya as well. I have unfortunately been in that situation as well, and I've had to tear kriya because I was there when someone passed away. However, nowadays we know that the custom is most people wait to tear kriya. And they wait till the time of the funeral. And there's a number of times when they would wait, but they're referred to as sha'at chimum, a time of great emotion, that they tear kriya. But why would they wait? And so again, Rav Tukachinsky and the Geshe Chaim suggest three different possibilities. One is that when someone passes away, there may not be anyone around to help them know how to do it the right way. In his terminology, sha'az yeshnam chevre kedisha b'kiyim, that they wait until the time of the funeral when you have the chevre kedisha, when people there know how to tear kriya. And so maybe that's why we wait, so people won't do it the wrong way. The second possibility he suggests is that there may be something about having other people help in the tearing of kriya, and you don't always have other people there at that moment of when a person passes away. The third he suggests is actually, and this ties into one of the customs in Yerushalayim, Minhag Yerushalayim is, the custom of Yerushalayim is that immediate relatives, in terms of sons, do not attend the burial. They can go to the funeral, but they're not allowed to attend the burial. And the one time where everyone is together is probably at the time of the eulogies. And so maybe he suggests that's the reason why we wait. Different rabbis have different approaches. Some tear before the eulogies, some tear after the eulogies, some tear at the exact time of the burial. It depends on a lot of different factors. Source, the plate on page 4, source 9, talks about after the burial. Now, the burial itself, there is a mitzvah, obviously, in the burial, as we mentioned earlier. There is a question of can immediate relatives who are mourners participate in the shoveling of earth into the grave or not. Rabbi Schwartz, who should have a refuah shlema, taught us that actually you should wait until there's 6 tfachim, about 2 feet of earth already in the grave. And his reasoning was that until that point, the mourners are still onanim. They still don't have the mitzvah to participate in the burial. But after that point, they're already under the status of mourners of Avelim, and they have their obligations of mitzvah again. But when people come back after the Shura, when they come back to the house, the next thing that happens is the Sudat Havra'ah. Sudat Havra'ah, the word Havra'ah comes from the same word as like Bari. Its source, actually, we find in Sefer Shmuel, that when David HaMelech came back after Avner's death, Avner was his chief, of his army, and he was killed, or the chief, I'm sorry, of the army of the other side, and he was killed by Yoav and Abishai as retribution for having killed their brother, Asael, that David HaMelech was beside himself that his loyal soldiers had done such a terrible thing. By a vocal am lahavrot David, and all of the people came to revive David, lechem bodayom, and they brought bread on that day. That's the basis of it. And the other source to it is on the first day of Avilut, an Avil is supposed to be eating food from someone else. That's why when it comes to the Sudat Havra'ah that takes place right after the Avilim come back to sit Shiva, they're supposed to have a meal, they're supposed to wash. It's somebody else's meal that comes to them. It's part of that revival, part of taking care of them. However, the Sudat Havra'ah in source 10 doesn't take place late in the afternoon on Erev Shabbat. Once you're past 9 hours on Erev Shabbat, we don't do it anymore. And similarly, if the burial happened on Chol HaMoed, you also wouldn't have the Sudat Havra'ah. But every other time you have a Sudat Havra'ah, the Avelim sit, they need to eat, and they also then need to bench. There is a special Birkat HaMazon for Beit Avel that some have the custom to do. It is not a very common custom anymore. Another side point, Rabbi Schwartz noted that in Chicago there was a custom that Avelim, even though they always sit on low chairs, when it came to meals, they would sit in regular chairs. He found a source for it in the Moedim Zmanim, Rav Sternbach, on the Halachot of Tisha B'Av, and there is, if that's the custom in your community, then that is the custom. Now, during the week of Shiva itself, there is a famous machloket about, is Shiva biblical in origin or rabbinic? The Shulchan Aruch says that the first day of Avelut, which is the day of death and burial, is a deoraita, that morning it comes from the Torah. The other days are only the Rabbanan. And the Aruch HaShulchan, in the next paragraph in Source 11, talks about the fact that ultimately, this is a based on a great machloket between great rabbinic minds, between the Rambam, who said that Avelut was actually biblical, and the Balei HaTosfot, Rabbeinu Tam, and others who said it is only rabbinic in nature. Most of the customs, though, that we have during the week of Shiva really come from either rabbinic nature or custom themselves. And so in Source 12, the Shulchan Aruch lists the 11 different things that are prohibited during the week of Avelut. A person who's in mourning is prohibited from doing work. The work we're talking about is the kind of work like business work. They're allowed to turn on or off a light, obviously. It's not the melacha of Shabbat. They're prohibited from bathing and anointing themselves, from wearing leather shoes, marital relations. They can't learn Torah. We don't greet them in a normal fashion. The laundry and clean clothes are generally prohibited. There was a special kind of head covering that they used to wear, which we don't do anymore, which also is related to a special kind of thing they did in terms of turning over beds as well, and then prohibited in taking haircuts, shaving, and obviously the element of simcha. And that leads us to the top of page 5. In one of his Yahrzeit lectures for his father, Rav Soloveitchik Zitzel, talked about all of the different customs of Avelut. But he pointed out, and this is in bold in the middle of that paragraph, Ulam ikar hakiyum hu matzav nafshi shel dikaon nefesh v'atzavut. He said, ultimately, the source of everything we do is an element of sadness that needs to take place during that week of Shiva. If you remember the opening quote we started with, where the Rav talks about there's a gradualness of overcoming that pain. The week of Shiva, we don't ignore the pain. The week of Shiva is a time to be comforted, but the pain exists, And the attitude must exist. There's a halacha in Shulchan Aruch that, for example, that people who are sitting shiva shouldn't be holding small children or playing with small children. That brings a lot of joy. Obviously, a parent who's sitting shiva needs to take care of a child. It's something different. But there needs to be the right kind of attitude within a shiva house. And that's something that sometimes when people pay a condolence call, they violate unintentionally or unaware of what the rules are. In fact, at the back of the packet, I have a brief article that I wrote as an introduction to the sitter for the House of Mourning about how to pay a shiva call in the right way. That attitude is very, very important during the week of shiva. There are certain things that really don't have a strong basis. And so, for example, it is the custom to bring food to the shiva house so that the people who are sitting shiva are able to eat. However, there is a very strong statement. People say you're not allowed to take the food out of the shiva house. Ultimately, you can. And I quoted from the Nitei Gavriel. The Nitei Gavriel is Rabbi Gavriel Tziner. Rabbi Gavriel Tziner is a Rav in Borough Park, one of the most prolific halachic authors today. He has published more than 30-some volumes. And he talks about the fact of the different opinions, whether you take food out of shiva house or not. And at the end, it says, it doesn't seem there are those who say there's absolutely no restriction. And really, that's the rule. The food we don't take out of a shiva house, in principle, is the food that was in the shiva house at the time the person passed away. And generally, that's only talking about a shiva house in which the person passed away in the house as opposed to somewhere else. If people bring food into the shiva house, it's permitted entirely to bring it out. Now, during the week of shiva, one of the greatest restrictions is the idea of bathing. And the idea of bathing is that, again, it's a question of not crimping ourselves during the week of shiva. And the Gemara says, v'hilchata, avel asur lechotz kol gufo ben b'chamin ben tzonim kol shiva, that a person who's a mourner is not allowed to bathe their entire body, take a shower, take a bath, whether it's in cold, whether it's in hot water, all shiva. But to wash just your hands, your face, your feet in cold water is fine. But to anoint yourself, which we normally identify as a kind of perfuming, any amount is prohibited. But if just to get rid of some of the schwitz, it's permitted. Now, the Shulchan Aruch does introduce one more piece. And this prohibition of bathing is exempted for a person who's called an istinus. An istinus is a person who is very, very particular about their hygiene, to the extent that if they're not bathed on a very regular basis, they're very uncomfortable with themselves. They may not be able to sleep, may not be able to sit. And therefore, when it comes to an istinus, there an istinus is allowed to bathe, even during the week of shiva. But the Shulchan Aruch writes that not everyone is considered v'lo kol misha amar istinus ani mutarin. If someone says, I'm an istinus, I want to take a bath, I want to take a shower during the week of shiva, we don't necessarily permit it. But it's only a person who really we know is that kind of person and really is always very careful about their personal hygiene. Rav Schechter, in his Ikvei Atzon, talks about the fact that why would an istinus be permitted to bathe? And it's simply because avelut is not about inflicting upon yourself pain and suffering. It's not something that we want to make this person suffer by not being able to take care of his needs. And therefore, an istinus was never even prohibited from bathing. That wasn't part of the original decree. The Pnimei Halacha, which is Rav Melamed, in a halacha which he offered, notes very simply one more piece. And he says that even somebody during the week of shiva, who because he just feels so uncomfortable, he may have been sweating so much that he just can't sleep because of this, would be allowed to take a brief shower, even in lukewarm water. Doesn't have to be ice cold. Machloket, whether lukewarm is called cold or called hot, he permits even that. And Rav Aviner ends this discussion with saying, Istinis hainu adam regish, it's a sensitive person, is called an istinis. Be'amenu kulanu regishim. We're all nowadays istinisim. And the reason is because we shower every day. Some people shower twice a day. And in those times of the Shulchan Aruch, you would bathe once a week for Shabbat. And so to bathe during the week of Shiva, according to Rav Aviner, is to do more than you would normally do. Nowadays, when people bathe every single day, to take 3 or 4 or 5 days consecutively and not bathe is unbearable for most people. And therefore, he would permit as well, and many do permit, a brief, quick shower if somebody is sitting in the week of Shiva, if it's necessary. Not everyone who wants to can, but it depends if that person is really an istinis. Source 14 talks about mirrors. Now, there are a lot of different reasons that are offered regarding why we cover mirrors in a Shiva house. I've heard, and the Gesher HaChaim refers to, that we say the neshama of the person could be seen in the mirror, and therefore we cover them in the week of Shiva. Others say that because we're not concerned about hygiene, that we cover the mirrors. Rav Shechter quotes in the Sefer Kavod HaRav, in the name of Rav Soloveitchik, that the reason we cover the mirrors is actually based on a more ancient custom. There was a custom in the time of the Gemara that they would upend, turn over sofas and beds during the week of Shiva. Nowadays, we don't have this custom anymore. But he said that the analogous custom is turning around the mirror. Well, how is that in some way analogous? He says the idea was that we turn over the beds because we say that a person passed away, the image of God has passed. And so we make some kind of passing, we turn things over. He says the very same thing is the reason for the mirrors today, because when we see ourselves in a mirror, we're seeing the image of God. This person has passed away. The image of God has passed away, Bavanotenu, through our own fault at the sins, and therefore we cover over the mirrors. If we don't turn them over, we cover them during the week of Shiva. But based on that, he said, we then uncover the mirrors for Shabbat. And this was Rav Soloveitchik's position, and it's based on the fact that the beds that were turned over in the ancient times were up, were put back in their normal fashion for Shabbat. So he says you can uncover that on Shabbat. Source 15, and we're coming near the end, but Source 15 talks about one of the things that's prohibited during the week of Shiva, and that's learning Torah. We say learning Torah is prohibited during the week of Shiva because Torah is the greatest joy for a Jewish person. It's mesamech lev. And therefore, how can we learn Torah? So the only kind of Torah that an avil can learn are Hilchot Avilut, or the sad portions of Tanakh, or reading Musar, things that don't bring that same kind of joy to a person's life. However, the question then arises, well, in a Shiva house, there's a custom between Mincha Maariv that they learn Mishnayot. How can that be? Now, Mishnayot is the natural thing to learn because Mishnah and Neshama are the same letters. And that's why even during COVID, for example, when we weren't allowed to have minyanim, people who were saying Kaddish for the year, the recommendation to them was learn Mishnayot instead of saying Kaddish. It is a zchut, a merit to the neshama of people, to the people's souls. The Tshuva of the Hanagot, which is Rav Sternbach, he writes that according to the Mekubalim, that ultimately learning between Mincha Maariv is the idea of repairing the soul of those who have passed away. And therefore, even though the mourner is not allowed to learn, it's a good thing to be learning in a house of mourning. It's for a different purpose. It's not to bring about the simcha, but it's for the different purpose and should be permitted. Rav Avigdor Nevinzel, the former chief rabbi of the old city of Yerushalayim, he actually writes that the idea behind this is because when we talked about learning wasn't permitted in the Beit Avil, it was talking about learning in the house of a Rosh Yeshiva, whose yeshiva had been closed. And so you weren't allowed to replace it in the Beit Avil. That wasn't the place to do it. But for a regular person, if there's a she'ur going on between Mincha and Maariv, a class going on, they're learning Mishnah between Mincha and Maariv, it's permitted. And in his words, "Ve'en avil chayav la'atom ozna v'lishmo agam kishim osipim divrei Torah toch kedei alimud." He says the avil doesn't have to close off his ears and not listen, even though he may be prohibited from learning those very same things that are being taught between mincha ma'ariv. The last piece is just a question of shloshim. We have a principle in halacha that miktsat hayom kikulo, that a portion of the day when it comes to avilut is considered as if it's the entire day. And so, as you may recall, Shiva ends in the morning. Even though it's just the morning of the seventh day, they haven't completed a full 7 days. Which means on the seventh day, not only does Shiva conclude, but the restrictions of Shloshim immediately begin. Shloshim and Shiva, in almost every case, both start from the time, the first day of Shiva. When you start sitting Shiva, that's day one of this 30-day period, the first 7 days of which are the most restrictive, and the next 23 days are lesser in terms of restriction. But that's the Shiva and the Shloshim. It's not 7 days plus 30. It's 30 days, first seven, one additional piece. The morning, the Miktsat Hayom Kikulo, is the principle that when you start sitting in the morning already, that's enough, and that counts as the seventh day. And then afterwards, you begin. There are some exceptions to this where we find two levels. One is someone who passes away on Chol HaMoed, where the funeral takes place on Chol HaMoed. Shloshim actually begins before the Shiva begins. It's an unusual thing because Shiva doesn't start until after Yom Tov is over. The other situation which you have where people often are confused, and that's the issue of what happens when a burial was on Sunday, which means that the seventh day is Shabbos. When do you get up from Shiva? And the answer is you get up from Shiva on Shabbos when people go to shul. That's the time of the end of Shiva. No one's coming over to the house. There is a way actually to comfort mourners on Shabbat. We generally don't do it, but there is a way. It's brought in Shulchan Aruch. But on the other hand, Friday, that Friday is a full day of Shiva. And it only stops moving backwards on how much time a person needs to get ready for Shabbat itself. And so Miktsat Hayom Kikulo is on the seventh day of Shiva, but if the sixth day of Shiva is Erev Shabbat, it doesn't apply, obviously, to that. Now, once you hit the period of Shloshim, the additional prohibitions that remain are haircutting and also the element of Simcha and an element of clean clothes as well. Now, during the week of Shiva, and there is this great debate, can an avel change clothes? And the answer is that if what they were wearing got dirty, they don't have to sit in the dirty clothes. But for a father, when a person is sitting Shiva for a parent, if they change, let's say, an upper garment, a shirt, or put on a different dress, they would have to tear kriya on it again. The custom is to remain with the Shiva clothes all week. But there was also a prohibition, for example, of clean clothes during the Shloshim period. It's not something we continue any longer. The Aruch HaShulchan, who was the late 19th, early 20th century, writes very simply that even on the Shabbat of Avinu, the Shabbat during the week of Shiva, person dresses into a clean shirt, okay? And anyone else, okay, that if he doesn't do it, it's chasidut shel shtut. It's improper piety or foolish piety. And he says, how much more so in the month of Shloshim? That no one would think that a person would continue to wear dirty clothing during the week of Shloshim, even though that was the original halakha that people did not. Nowadays, the major issue that happens during the month of the Shloshim following the Shiva is a question of haircuts. And on haircuts, we say until the end of Shloshim, at least the principle is ad shi garu bo chavirav, until your friends begin to explain to you that the time has come. You don't look good anymore. The time has come to get a haircut. And at that point, a person is allowed to get their haircut. That is the 30 days itself. And then just to conclude on two notes, the idea of mourning is really not about the mourning, but about the repair from the mourning. Meaning that the way halakha structures our mourning is to bring us back into life. We should be very, very fortunate that it gives us a time. And if you think about the most meaningful Shiva houses you may have visited, the most meaningful Shiva calls you may have been to, is where you hear stories and lessons from the person who passed away. which can inspire and also comfort the mourners themselves when they understand the impact that the person had on the world around them, whether it's the immediate world of family or the extended world of community or beyond itself. Nevertheless, it does force us to go out once again. And so slowly but surely, we have to go back to this world. And so the idea of mourning is to know both how we can repair ourselves and that there's an end to mourning. That when you hit mourning for anyone but a parent, at the end of Shloshim, the official period of mourning is over. For a parent, it's at the end of the year, the mourning is over. And we don't believe as Jews that we should continue the kind of mourning beyond the period we're allowed to do so. We believe in building up life based on the foundations that were created for us. That's one piece to just remember. And that also is the idea that you find in the Gemara when we talk about those who mourn over Yerushalayim, that anyone who is then mourning over Jerusalem is able to ultimately rebuild Jerusalem. We'll see the rebuilding of Jerusalem. Because if you understand concepts, you understand how things should be done, you also can see the greatness that can come out. Final note before I conclude, and that is that the other pieces of information that you have in here, these are just, again, there's a summary. It's not that long, but it's a pretty good summary of the laws of Avilut. As well, there is a piece that is based on Rav Rimon. He allowed me to translate it and also include it in this as well. And then finally, is that piece that I've included as well of the how to do a proper Shiva call. I thank you for the opportunity to address this evening this wonderful group of people. I thank Emma Katz for inviting me, and I look forward to talking about a simcha next time and to sharing smachot with all of you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.